Hello, hello, hello. I'm Michael Hintz, the velvety voice of Vino, with another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. And it's hello from my producer, the peripatetic urbane Lloyd Shirley. Looking $1 million today, Lloyd. Today we're going to meet the ebullient Josh Elias, editor of The Stylish, authoritative, that's hard to say this time of the day, entertaining drinks quarterly Alchemy, which celebrates its first birthday with the release of Edition 4. But first, my wine of the week is a 2013 Seppel Drumberg Chardonnay. Alcohol 13.1. Gee, they sneak that 0.1 in there just to see that we're paying attention. Screw cap seal, what isn't? And excellent value for money. The winemakers are Adam Carnaby and Mel Chester. That sounds like a name of a firm of solicitors, doesn't it? Carnaby and Chester. Anyway, the visionary Carl Seppel knew what he was doing when he planted the I think it was about 100-hectare cool climate Drumberg vineyard at Henty in Victoria's far southwest. It's one of Australia's, well, I think it's the most southerly vineyard in the mainland in Australia, and the region's known for its pure, pristine, exceptional quality fruit, as exemplified by its Chardonnays, Rieslings, and Pinot Noir. As I say, the Henty wine region is in the southwestern part of Victoria, about 300 kilometres west of Melbourne. Unfortunately, a lot of people pass through it because it doesn't have many cellar doors as yet, pass through it on their way to Adelaide and the Barossa. Now, Henty's cold, wet winters and warm, dry summers, followed by a long, cool autumn ripening period, yield fruit that ripens later than many other regions, resulting in superb, intense varietal flavours. This 2013 Seppel Drumberg Chardonnay is an excellent example of the consistently fine wines. Now, the wine is golden white in colour, with pervasive aromas of lemony citrus melded with a nutty brioche on the nose, leading to a generous, somewhat flinty, pithy grapefruit come stone fruit palate, tinged with honeysuckle. How's that for a melange? Are you with me? You're probably still stuck on the flinty bit. Yeah, I know what you mean. Now, the middle palate complexity is complemented by a subtle French oak, with a bit of an accent, of course, and mineral acid, resulting in a balanced wine of intensity, depth, and subtlety that rewards from first sip to the last lingering aftertaste. It's a premium quality cool climate single vineyard Chardonnay at its best from a top producer. Now, in this fast-moving cyberspace age of the internet and social media, bursting with instant information and chattering incessant opinion, where quality is continually threatened to be overrun by quantity, it's refreshing to see the timelessness of the printed word re-emerge and rise above the clutter in the miasma of all this happening of the so-called wine, food and lifestyle magazines. Celebrating its first birthday is Alchemy, a quarterly publication devoted to drinks, which is subtly complemented by a smart online presence. And its editor-in-chief, not just an editor, you know, you have to be an editor-in-chief, Josh Elias is joining us today to reveal the essence of Alchemy. And you're probably saying now, how do you spell Alchemy? Have you got your pens ready? Or you keyed up? Alquimie. Have you got that? Yes, well done. Josh, welcome to Grapevine and happy first birthday.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having us.
Ah, well, I hope you're saying that at the end of the program, and no doubt our listeners will be. First of all, tell me a little bit about yourself, your professional background, and your interest in drinks and wine in particular.
My professional background is on the floor in restaurants, so working for the last 7.5, 8 years in fine dining as a sommelier on the floor. Even more professional before that was a law
degree. I hope you weren't on the floor, you were standing up.
Oh, standing up, although tasting wine does have the tendency to leave you on the floor. But we do generally, when tasting wine for customers in restaurants, spit the wine just to make sure that everything's okay and it's not corked.
Yep.
However, I did do a law degree originally when I was at school, at university, moving on into the law profession. I decided that I didn't quite like the practice as much as I like the theoretical. Mm-hmm. And wine had this lovely balance where the theoretical was shown in the glass. Mm-hmm. So I decided to work my way into hospitality, and after working in fine dining.
You didn't think you'd go into a law firm specialising in advising the wine industry, did you?
No, there's quite a few of those, as it is actually, surprisingly enough. And even more lawyers with vineyards, I would not be hesitant to suggest.
Mm.
But in terms of our professional undertaking, in terms of the magazine, that's something more recent, as you can tell by the first birthday. And that was something that I segued into after fine dining and hospitality work. I was approached by the graphic designer Nick Carey, who is a partner in the business, together with James Morgan, who's the photographer, and Raoul, who's a gentleman who helps us source contributions around the world as well.
Now, what's Raoul's surname? How do you
Moreno Yagüe.
Thank you. You can pronounce it properly. I wouldn't dare try. Yes. Yeah. Now, define alchemy. Why alchemy and why now?
Alchemy is really a drinks publication that's all about context. So there's a timelessness, as you mentioned. It's very much about telling the stories on the dining table, giving a reference point to wine. I mean, you would know from your background working with the Epicurean that food, wine is, you know, an irresistible combination. So to look at the way that wine's been treated in journalism over the last 10 to 15 years in terms of in a museum box with a velvet glove, 100 points sort of treatment, that sort of idea for us wasn't very appealing. I think that it leads to absurdity in terms of the reference points about the way that an agricultural product is made and enjoyed, most importantly. So we sought about recreating the understanding and relationship that the consumer has with wine in order to take it back from what am I buying for my cellar to drink in 30 years, which is also a very valid concern, but more importantly...
Not at my age, it isn't, Josh. Yeah. It's all right for you.
But more importantly, what am I drinking tonight and who am I drinking it with, and bring that combination together.
Yes. Now, it's early days as yet, but looking back on a very hectic first 12 months, how would you say you've evolved editorially since edition one in terms of... refinement, I suppose, because with each edition comes a little refinement, doesn't it? It's a little like making a wine. You know, it takes a few vintages before the winemaker gets familiar with the grape and can really go into their own. So how would you describe the last 12 months in terms of refinement?
For sure. I mean, in terms of the first edition, I would say that the editorial footprint was stamped on quite strongly. We edited articles very strongly, despite, you know, having an array of contributors from very, very experienced wine writers through to less experienced. And I think that was part of developing a real alchemy identity in a way. As we've gone through the subsequent three editions, I would say we've relaxed that a little bit, but still we are staunchly timeless. So we make a big point of trying to make sure that everything that comes through our door from a contribution perspective, which we do collaborate on, it's not just provide us with a contribution at the end of the quarter. It's really a discussion about how that article will take shape. But we've relaxed into letting that author free rein a little bit more, allowing them to take their own spin a little bit more from an editorial perspective. And also that happens to be with food. I mean, in the third edition, Tony Tan, who's one of the most fantastic writers we have in Australia, specifically with Chinese history and Chinese food, he wanted to go full bore with an article on the sub-regionality of Chinese cuisine, which in Melbourne is something that's limited very much to Cantonese cooking.
Yes.
And so he expanded on that, and lo and behold, it came in at 4,000 words, and we ran with it. So, you know, that was something where we let it loose, and I don't think we would have done that with the first edition. We might have tried to more tightly rein it towards a beverage inclination. Yeah.
That's a good example. I can see you doing the same for... for Indian food, perhaps. Get someone to do the same.
Absolutely. I think that Indian food is a very much underestimated for its sub-regionality.
Now, who reads Alchemy?
It's a pretty diverse subset. I mean, in terms of demographics, when we meet with advertisers, when we meet with distributors, it's a funny conversation because it's certainly not ageist. It has a broad demographic in terms of people with a cursory interest in wine, right through to hardened enthusiasts who really look at themselves as connoisseurs. It is, well, I would say it's a predominantly male market for our publication, and maybe that's influenced by, you know, articles on whiskey and cognac and things like that. But in terms of demographic, it's certainly the 30 to 55-year-old male, and that's a person who wants to explore, you know, their interest in whiskey and take that over to wine, but we try to keep it accessible. So it's not just for someone who has an interest in wine, it's for someone who's looking to expand their knowledge base in all drinks and how to use them in their home and also how to order in restaurants, etc.
Now, that's interesting because I think it's not parochial, which is another way of saying it's international, but you've got to be careful when you say a thing's international. In Australia, people think you're trying to be above yourself, so you've got to be very careful there. But it has a broad, very broad palate. And I've had feedback from people in London. I've had people in America say, "Oh, I've read this." So you're sort of quietly popping up all over the place, aren't you? You've got a very broad readership. Yeah, and it's not just Australia.
Yeah, there's we try and keep it quite culturally diverse, and from a distribution perspective, there was a conscious decision to acknowledge the fact that in Australia we have a large degree of influence culturally from overseas. We look at ourselves as European. The coffee culture in Melbourne, Sydney, those sort of things are inspired by the espresso ideals of Italy. So we have to think that, generally speaking, media per se will also take root overseas in order to achieve national accreditation and respect. And we did allocate 20% of our distribution, or roughly around there, which varies a small amount, in key places like London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, France, just basically in particular Paris and Northern Italy. But subscribers subsequently pop up in those regions as well once they've had a taste for it. The idea being that that will trickle down into Australia, informing our cultural opinions.
Yes, I had coffee. That's interesting about, I had Darren Silverman on Table Talk recently from Black Velvet Coffee. And I asked him this question, and this is a slight diversion, because you do, it's a drinks quarterly, not just wine. But why is so many Italian names associated with coffee? Every second brand of coffee is an Italian name. And Darren was struggling to answer that, and I'm struggling to answer it. Is that a cultural thing? Is it just a...
I'm quite interested by that because naturally that is a cultural thing in the north of Italy. And even, I mean, my fiancé's grandfather, he set up a cafe recently. And when he did so, he bought a massive steel drum, hollowed it out, set it over hot coals, and decided to roast coffee himself, despite the plethora of roasteries in the middle of the Docklands. So he decided that, you know, he was going to take upon himself to enliven his Calabrian childhood, which was this idea of home roasting coffee. So it's something that was obviously a family ideal. But I think also for me, there's a strong marketing thing at play here. Like, I look at the prominence of prosciutto as a small good in Australia.
Yes.
When I go to Spain and I see jamón and how many different types and how elaborately curated it is, I can't help but think that the Italians have been much better at exporting their products globally than the Spanish have. Yes. And so there's certainly a degree of marketing in that.
Right. Yes, that's fascinating. Now, you've also got a wine of the week. So I thought it'd be a nice thing because usually I have, speaking to winemakers, and of course they naturally have a wine of the week, but I thought, Josh, I'd give you free rein to bring in a wine and talk about it. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Josh Elias's Wine of the Week.
It's a very profound introduction. It's a 2012 Marilla Estate from Tasmania. This is, most people would know the museum, the Mona, the Museum of Old New Art. And the project, I guess, with Conor van der Oost as a winemaker is an interesting one because it's very much about enlivening the old historical winery from Claudio Al Corso, which was well predating the museum. And the idea behind this is the cloth label series, and I've got the white in front of me here, which is a 2012. David Walsh, a very opinionated and amazing pioneer for Australian cultural interests in art, and more generally, you know, if you go there, Mona is a sensory experience.
Does he have anything in common with Howard Hughes? He's a bit elusive, bit of a recluse, isn't he?
He is, I believe so. Yeah, you see him wandering around when you do go there to visit the museum. Right. But he's what they've translated to in terms of the Marilla project is quite exciting, and they haven't really released a reserve wine per se. But this cloth label has, as you would expect, a cloth label, and it's a tribute to Claudio Accorso's.
Has it got the original Aboriginal motive on the front?
I'm not sure.
Marilla was.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it does. No.
It's
just an
modern.
X. Mm. Yeah, it's a modern kind of branding. But the Claudio Accorso originally was in a textile business.
That's right.
And so he used to use silk for his labels a lot of the time. So I really love that connection back to the past.
Mm.
And this is a field blend, which is, again, maybe something that's a bit more traditional with all types of grape, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, a little bit of Pinot Noir, which was pressed off the skins quickly. Just adds a bit of acidity.
So a blended white.
Yeah, yes. It's really a field blend, old school sort of, these are the grapes we have, this is the wine we'll make.
At 11.4 alcohol ABV,
yeah.
I think, here.
Yeah, and I think that when you have things like sparkling Pinot base, it's going to lower the alcohol on the wine. And it is a textured white. It has great mid-palate texture in terms of silk and, you know, speaking with a velvety voice, it's you know, this is literally a silky wine. And the bitterness on the back palate is something that brings it back to food and it snaps back. It is a lean style white, but, you know, considering that it is such low alcohol, I was really surprised by the texture in the wine, and it's quite a delicious drink.
Oh, lovely. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. Now, I find it refreshing that, like the lead English wine critic Hugh Johnson, you don't rate or score wines numerically. Rather, you treat the reader with a modicum of respect, in that you prefer to put things into perspective, or I think you mentioned the word context before. Tell me about this. This is obviously a deliberate strategy, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very much about paying full respect to the entire timeline of wine production. The process of putting a score next to a wine, I believe, is very much a sales point. It's very much something that was marketably and commercially derived. And it is almost sycophantic in its following these days. It's speedy, it's timely, and it's something to promote instant sales. But I feel that in that rhetoric, we often end up writing, well, not us particularly, but the broader industry, about too many wines, putting too many scores, and not, you know, adequately showing respect for the process of viticulture and winemaking. And I think that over time, you know, hopefully we can move back from the scoring process and to a more elaborate conversation about where was this wine grown, how was it made, and more importantly, how is it intended to be enjoyed. And I think that, you know, that that's part of a broader landscape where we can really identify with wine producers, you know, as agricultural, you know, and in Australia we have a great history of agriculture across the board, and there's no reason that wine should be any different from that.
Well, there's a bit of King Canute or Don Quixote here, because you're flying against the, you're going against the tide very much. And look, I've got to say, I agree with you 100%. There's nothing that kills a conversation very quickly than a points assessment. It sort of cuts things stone dead. And look, I'm very much in agreement and akin to what you're trying to do, or what you.
I think also it's quite authoritarian and dictatorial. And I think that it's basically saying that here is an objective number for this particular wine. And if anything, it's completely lost, because a number in essence is a subjective rating.
Yes.
And people forget that. And I think that's something that is, as I said, liable to absurdity if we follow it too strongly.
Now, you've got four tenets of your manifesto. One's perception goes far beyond desirable taste. Two, the context in which we drink is as important as what we drink. Hear, hear. The creation of drink informs our understanding of it. And to understand the value of alcohol, we must first appreciate each other. But now, could you just take us through that? Because this is a very deliberate manifesto that you've set out to maintain, and when you're commenting on that, how hard is it to stay true to what you're trying to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in terms of a manifesto for a publication such as ours, which prides itself on objectivity and trying to devoid ourselves as being authoritarian and dictatorial, a manifesto is one of the few opportunities where we got to prove our exact feelings, opinions, and undertones as to how we write and how we decide what we engage as content. And it also duly showed respect what I believe to be, you know, a product that has a double-edged sword. Alcohol, you know, is intoxicating. It's something that is often, you know, in terms of its effects, it's often underplayed as being a legal consumable, which is mind-altering. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to be, you know, respectful of that process and understand its role within Australian, you know, consumption. But then, you know, as well as that, when we decide our content, do we, you know, consider context? Absolutely. How difficult is it to consider that? How difficult is it to remember that, you know, we're not trying to glorify alcohol consumption? I think that if you are looking at just a certain amount of wine and you're not looking at overconsumption and 400 tasting notes and nothing but golden images and golden glows of bottles themselves, then I think you do generally have a balanced approach. If you do what I suggested and you basically concentrate on the product in isolation, then you can be led astray quite easily. And you just got to remember to take a step back. And if someone who is less initiated in wine reads my article and doesn't understand what I'm talking about, then I'm probably falling into a position whereby the content is devoid of those ideals that we have in the manifesto.
Right. And these are encapsulated in your four segments, because one's called the story, then there's the study, then there's the palate, then there's the excess. Now, take us through good examples of each of these, would you?
Sure. Well, the palate is the tasting section, so right. That's tangibly, that's the wine in your glass, looking at the wine, tasting the wine, much like your wine of the week in that respect. It really is teasing out how the wine tastes. And the fact that that's only a quarter of the magazine sort of shows you the broader approach, which is lifestyle-based. The story is something that I love being involved in, love accepting contributions for, because it's so romantically intertwined with someone's journey. It's very much about following somebody in their, where they've been, where they're going, and their everyday nuances now. The study is something that's very technical. It's about specific micro elements of wine production, spirits production, drinks production, and looking and teasing out the very fine threads that put it together. And
that's for the melancholy in people who want to go into depth. Yeah. And I mean that in the truest sense of the word, who are interested in the technical side and the scientific mind, if you like.
Yeah, and they want they're asking the why questions about what they taste.
Yes.
And then finally the excess, which is sort of tangential musings where you can set off to the side and imagine, you know, yourself in the position of somebody else or imagine having a drink that you wouldn't have otherwise thought of. And these are, you know, the sort of, they can be personality-based, but they can also be product-based, and it's just about imagination and taking you somewhere else.
I can see we're going to have to get you back next year to talk, because we're hardly into the program and it's almost finished, a sign of a good program. I've really got to slip this in, and this is a personal question in terms of preference. If you had your choice and you were having a dinner party, what four people, living or dead, would you invite to your dinner party?
That's really difficult. In terms of living or dead, I, being the editor of a wine publication doesn't necessarily mean that I would necessarily invite wine personalities.
Hooray! That's a relief.
I think as interesting as it is to talk about wine, the conversations can sometimes be circular, especially when there's passionate people of divulgent opinions in the room. So I would certainly, Hundress Thompson would be someone that I would have there. I'm not sure how the dinner party would end and whether there would even be dinner consumed, but they would be a very joyous time for us all, I'm sure. Otherwise, in terms of writers, A.A. Gill is someone I'd love to chat to, have him at a dinner party. I mean, his humour, his general wit. I mean, he's very, again, these are all cutting personalities, because I think that there's no point in pleasantries if we're getting a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And I think also a musician of sorts, and I'm not exactly sure who that would be, but If Bob Dylan wasn't so jaded, it would be someone like him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, someone like John Lennon would also be equally interesting. Someone who's mm-hmm. had a profound influence on the general public
mm-hmm.
And knowing how their ideals married up to what the subsequent consequence was.
What about Gore Vidal if he was still alive?
Well, that would be certainly quite interesting.
right. Now, you've... I believe, being called the Steve Jobs of Australian wine publishing. Now, why do people... That's a rather hefty compliment, or is it a bit of a dig, knowing the Australian sense... The Australian sense of humour?
Yeah, well,
G'day, Steve.
I took it as a compliment, but I wasn't really quite sure how to react, to be honest, because right. it's certainly not something I look at myself as, considering how conservative the wine industry is and how advanced the technological industry is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a unique comparison. But at the same time, you know, you take it with one hand and you dismiss it with the other, because you've got a job to do and work ahead of you.
Right. Well, look, we're going to have to finish here because there's a massive NFL gridiron game coming up on the TV, and San Francisco are playing. The 49ers are playing, and Josh is an avid fan. So when he's not doing impersonations of John Safran and other people and not having disasters with his wine cellar, he's watching the 49ers. Look, Josh, thank you very much for joining us today, and please do come back, because we've barely scratched the surface of this wonderful publication. And thank you for your time, and every continued success to a very classy publication. Long may alchemy prosper.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Well, my research material was sourced from, of course, alchemy.com.au, and years of enjoyable imbibing. This has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio, heard on stations all around Australia via the Community Radio Network. It's cheers from me, Michael Hintz, and please drink moderately.